Do please be opening your Bible up to Colossians chapter 3. We will be looking there in just a moment. It will be the place where we will start. It's been so good for me to be with you today. A lot of time has passed, but I used to spend a good bit of time here. Some of you may not believe that. You look in here and you don't know who I am, but I spent a lot of time here in years past, and I feel like, I'm not ranking anybody here, but I probably feel like I have two homes, and East Hill is one of them. Can I say that? Would that be fair? I have two homes, and I feel like East Hill is one of them. There's so many people here who have been an encouragement to me in a special way. I don't want to name any names because really it's anybody probably who's been here and who was here when I was attending regularly, and especially when I was a single guy trying to serve the Lord, and it was just difficult at times, and at times it could be lonely, and so many of you just, were there for me, and your families were there for me, and I appreciate that so much, and don't think that I have forgotten that, and I'm just thankful for this opportunity. I'm so thankful that you would ask me to study with you. And so I just want to tell you that I appreciate you, and I always enjoy being with you. And I'm thankful for the Lord who has brought us together, thankful for those relationships. And that has a little bit of something to do with what I'm going to talk about this evening. I want to talk about some reasons to marry a faithful Christian. And, this is a subject that someone might say, well, wow, someone maybe that knows some of these young people a little bit more personally needs to be saying these kinds of things to them. But I am mostly talking to young people. I'm talking to people who are not married. But if you don't know me, let me just say this. Think of it this way. Think of me as adding my voice to the voice of what I suspect you're already hearing from your parents and from your grandparents. And I want you to listen to some of the things that I say and see if it's not very similar to what your parents and your grandparents may be telling you, and some of the elders and the Bible class teachers, whoever may be speaking to you about these things. And let me just say this, that I know that this can be a difficult and sensitive subject. Sometimes it affects people's relationships that already exist. And so what I want to ask you to do is please just give this lesson a chance. Please hear me out. I'm not trying to embarrass anyone with a lesson like this. But the purpose of a lesson like this is based on a couple of things. The first one being that, believe it or not, most people will marry. I know you're looking at some of these young people right now. Maybe brothers are looking at sisters, and sisters are looking at brothers, and they're saying, I don't think so. But believe it or not, even those people that they probably will marry. And so, that being the case, the Bible has a lot to say about marriage and a lot about our relationships in marriage and our responsibility. And I just believe that based on what the Bible says, it would be best for a Christian to marry another faithful Christian. And so, just going forward, think about some of these things with me. And we will say this again at the end of the lesson. This is not a guarantee because, marriage is where your life begins. And the devil will look at two people who are trying to serve the Lord together, and he will give you his best shot. And some people, if their focus is not, if it's not in the right place, even people who have served the Lord faithfully for a long time, their marriage will not be able to endure some of those things. And so, just understand that we're talking about from the standpoint of what the Bible says about marriage, what would be best. Where does the wisdom of the Bible, in which direction does the wisdom of the Bible point us? And so I'm going to begin by just talking about four reasons why I believe it would be best for a Christian to marry a faithful Christian. And one of them is right here in Colossians 3. I really love the language of verse 4. Christ, who is our life, appears. Christ, our life, appears, then you will also appear with him in glory. You see in verse 3, you die. When you became a Christian, you died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. Your life goes away. And now it becomes not what I want, but what the Lord wants. And what the Lord tells me is best for me. You see, Christ is our life. And if we live in such a way so as to demonstrate that we have put our old man to death and that our life is hidden with Christ in God, then we live with the hope that when He appears, we will be with Him in glory. Let me think about some things that we could say along these lines. First of all, Christ is our life. How does that affect us? Jesus is the reason that we're here right now. Have you ever thought about that? Why are we all here? Jesus. If you didn't know Jesus, be honest. Do you think you'd know me? If I didn't know Jesus, be honest. Do you think I would know you? You see, Jesus Christ has brought us together. You are in my life and I'm in your life because of our mutual love, our mutual service of Jesus Christ. And so that's just one way to think about just what a tremendous impact Christ can have and should have on our lives. But we are supposed to have died. Look at what he says. We're supposed to be dead. We're supposed to be living in Him. We're supposed to be seeking those things which are above in verse 1. We're supposed to be setting our mind on the things that are above, not on the things of the earth. You see, we are to be busy as regenerated people, as converted people, seeking the things of our Lord. And we know that these things are the most important things. These are the things that are, you know, the things that prevail and ought to prevail over our pursuits and our interests in this life. Our pursuit of the kingdom of God and His righteousness has to be first and foremost above all things. And he says in verse 4, when Christ, who is our life, appears, you also will appear with Him in glory. We need to commit to that in such a way that shows that we really believe that He's coming back again. We need to commit to that, you know, in a way. You know, sometimes we think of commitment in different ways, and like someone commits to a job and says, I am committed to this job until someone offers me more money. That's not the way our commitment to Christ can be. No one can offer us more than what Jesus Christ can offer us. And so it has to be the preeminent commitment. We have to make that commitment like we believe that He's coming again. This is how you have ordered your life as a Christian. This is what your priorities are supposed to look like. There's nothing half-hearted about what Paul describes. But then if you marry someone who's not a Christian, their service to the Lord's not even going to be half-hearted. It's going to be non-existent. And so here's supposed to be the most important thing in your life is what you're building your life around. But this person is not building their life around the same thing that you're supposed to be trying to build your life around. And I just want you to realize and be honest that there is no chance that there's not going to be some difficulties along the way. And we might just ask ourselves a few Christians. For example, you know, why isn't my mate a Christian? This is so important to me, and obviously we have a lot in common. We love one another. Maybe we believe that we love one another. We have affection for one another. Why isn't my mate a Christian? Do they disagree with my choice? I mean, what is it? I'm a Christian. Why aren't you? Well, they might say, well, I don't agree with that choice of lifestyle. Does my mate understand who Jesus is? And if my mate is not a Christian, what is most important to them then? Because it's not going to be Jesus. It's not going to be living like we believe that Jesus is coming again. And so we have to be realistic that is going to lead to some challenges that are going to test and to try our faith at times. So, reasons to marry a faithful Christian. Number one, Christ is our life. Live like that and make choices like that is the case. Reason number two, you do not know that you will be able to convert your spouse. Now, let me begin by saying this. It is certainly possible. In 1 Peter 3 and verse 1, Peter says that wives ought to be submissive to their own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they without a word may be won by the conduct of their wives when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. So it is definitely possible to convert a spouse. And let me just say, when that happens, the people of God, we rejoice. That is something that we thank God for. We're so happy when it happens. But, you know, as you read this passage, make sure that we realize that it's possible, but it's not a guarantee. And Peter's not advising us to marry an unbeliever. He's not saying, you know, go marry an unbeliever, because if you're submissive to them and they don't obey the word, well, no, he's telling wives who are in this situation, here's what you can do. Okay, you're in this situation. You can't get a divorce. Paul talks about that in 1 Corinthians 7. You can't just get a divorce because your spouse is not a believer. And so what can you do? Well, wives can be submissive, and by their example, they may very well have an opportunity to convert their spouse. But it is not guaranteed. Because Paul says, in dealing with this subject in 1 Corinthians 7, Paul's language is this. He says, how do you know, in verse 16, O wife, whether you will save your husband? And there's no greater advantage for wives or for husbands, because he goes on to say, how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife? You see, you do not know that you will be able to convert your spouse. And in the context here in verse 15, he's talking about what to do if an unbeliever departs. In verse 15, if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. And so I point that out to say in verse 15 when he says, let him depart, I want you to see that Paul's tone is doubtful. It's not hopeful that you can make things work with an antagonistic unbeliever. And there's a difference, because he does talk about dwelling together with an unbeliever. It's not a cause for divorce. But when you get down here in verse 15, you're talking about someone who is not willing to stay with someone because of their faith. And in verse 16, he says, let him depart in verse 15, because in verse 16, how do you know that you will be able to save your husband? How do you know that you will be able to save your spouse or your wife? He's not saying, well, it may be difficult, but go ahead and try to make your marriage work with an antagonistic unbeliever so that you can try to convert them. No, that's not what he's saying. He's saying, don't try to save the marriage and jeopardize your faith. If someone is antagonistic toward your faith, let them go. Your faith and your relationship with God is more important than trying to maintain a relationship with someone who's trying to destroy your faith. One last thing that we'll say along these lines. You do not know whether you will be able to convert your spouse. Let me just admit something to you that most of the people in here probably know. I was converted by someone that I dated. I was converted by someone that I dated. And so as I thought about this lesson, I asked myself, and I thought, you know, at least I anticipated objections. Well, is it really consistent for you to preach a lesson like this? I mean, is it really consistent for you to tell Christians to only marry Christians? And I mean, how would you have been converted if someone had not taken a chance on you and you know dated you and took the time to, you know, to think about you and teach you? I've thought about that, and I want to reveal a little bit about what I think about my situation. First of all, I will say this. I didn't marry the girl who helped to convert me. So, you know, it's not a perfect parallel there. We didn't marry, and I still know her, and I still know her family. If I had not have become a Christian, I don't think she would have married me. I hope she wouldn't have. And so I think about myself kind of as in the same situation as someone like Ruth. When I was converted, I left the world. And I'm trying to lead my family in such a way so they never end up out in the world apart from Christ. See, we've come out of the world. And when Ruth left Moab, she wasn't going back. She wasn't going back. Do you remember what she said to Naomi? Naomi tried to send her home, and she says, entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. And she said, the Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts you and me. When Ruth left Moab, she wasn't going back. And I think of myself as a Ruth. You know, could you imagine Ruth just snuggling little baby Obed? that child that had been born to him. Sure would be good to go back to Moab, wouldn't it? I wish Obed could see his family back in Moab. I just don't think Ruth ever thought that. And that's the way I feel about my situation and my family. I am so thankful for the person who took the time to teach me, took a chance on me, but I know she wouldn't have married me if I had not become a Christian. And I want my girls to be able to say to the person that they intend to marry, I want them to be able to say, "Your God is my God." So here are some reasons to marry a faithful Christian. Christ is our life. You do not know that you will be able to convert your spouse. And for Christians, we ought to realize this, you know, better than anyone. But first and foremost, marriage is a spiritual endeavor. It's something that has spiritual implications, far-reaching spiritual effects and consequences. In marriage, two people are joined together by God. And thus, we conclude that marriage is a divine institution. In Matthew 19, verse 16, you know, Jesus says, "Therefore, the two have become one. Therefore, let what God has joined together, let not man separate. They are no longer two, but one flesh. And who joined them?" Jesus says, "God joined them." And so, if marriage is an institution of divine origin, and here's the thing about marriage, sometimes we might get confused because you don't have to be spiritual to experience some of the joy and blessings of marriage. There are people out there who are not very spiritual, but they are marrying and they are enjoying companionship and they are having children. And so maybe sometimes we forget that marriage is first and foremost about two people being joined together by God. It's not about pleasing ourselves. You know, it's not just about pleasing ourselves as human beings. God has set conditions of acceptable behavior within marriages. And there are certain ways that we can behave in our marriage that will please God. There are some things that we can do in marriage that will displease God. And so think of this. Realize this. Marriage is a spiritual endeavor. It's a spiritual journey that we're trying to take together, trying to get to the same place together. Turn to Ephesians 5. Ephesians 5. We just make this point that marriage teaches us about the love of Christ. You know, and here's just some relationships in which husbands and wives are compared to the relationship of Christ and His church. In verse 24 and 25, Paul says, "Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave Himself for her." And there's an interesting point that Paul makes in verse 32, and really he kind of makes this in verse 30 as well. "We are members of His body, of His flesh, and of His bones." He's kind of shifted from talking about marriage to talking about Christ and the church again. And he says, "This is a great mystery," in verse 32, "but I speak concerning Christ and the church." Which is interesting because he says that after quoting from Genesis 2 in verse 31. "For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church." And this is what I want to say to you. You know, if we were to ask the question, which came first, marriage or the cross? You know, the cross, the ultimate demonstration of Christ's love for the church. You know, we might open up our Bibles and we turn and we look in Genesis. Oh, well, look, there's Adam and Eve in Genesis 2. Marriage came first. It came before the cross, right? And that is true in a linear sense. But Christ is said to have fulfilled an eternal purpose in dying on the cross, which means that He loved the church before He ever went to the cross. And He loved the church before He ever made the world, before He ever made human beings. And I think really when Paul says, "This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church," he's wanting us to kind of look at our marriages and realize that there are some lessons to be learned intentionally, that God intended this way. There are some lessons to be learned in our marriages about Christ's love for the church. And I think we can see that in the Old Testament when God is described as a father and His people are described as His children. I mean, really, in Ezekiel 16, where You know, Israel is described as, you know, the wife of God, so to speak, where they're just left out by the road, a dead child struggling in their own blood. And God comes along and cares for them and nurtures them and brings them up. And eventually, you know, the child grows up and he puts his wings around the child and covers the child's nakedness and clothes the child with the best clothes and feeds him with the best food, puts fine jewelry on this child that has grown up into a beautiful woman. You know, there's language in the Old Testament that shows us, helps us to see that marriage was not just about fulfilling human pleasure. It was about learning lessons about how to love like God. And I believe that's exactly what the point of Paul's comparison here is. Let me make sure you understand what I'm talking about. I'm talking about Christ and the church. We can learn some wonderful lessons about love, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. And we look back now and we realize with clearer vision than ever before that we were supposed to be learning how to take the needs of another upon ourselves and to sacrifice so that those needs could be met. And so maybe you get all that and you understand, okay, yeah, I see that. I think you're right. I think that probably marriages have been given to us to help us understand God's love for us, to help us understand God's love for the church and Christ's love for the church. But what if my spouse doesn't know the love of Christ and I'm entering into this relationship with them and I need them to help me learn about the love of Christ, but they don't know about the love of Christ? It hasn't affected them. They haven't responded to it. I just want us to be honest about the fact that's going to cause some problems. And this may seem insignificant when we're young and in love and we've got stars in our eyes and we just, you know, they don't do anything wrong. They can't say anything wrong to me. But what about when it comes time to worship? And I want to go to worship and my spouse doesn't want to go to worship. Maybe I want to go to worship and we only have one car and my spouse wants to use the car for something else. And my spouse says, I'm going to use the car for something else. You're welcome to go to worship, but you're going to have to find a ride. What about when it's time to give to the Lord? Maybe when we're young and in love, we just can't imagine how it could possibly be any problematic in any way to marry someone who's not a Christian. But what about when it's time to give to the Lord? And you're sharing an income now. And the spouse says, well, I don't want to give to the Lord. That's not important to me. What about when it's time to raise up children, to know the Lord and to fear Him? Are we going to be able to work together to do that? Or am I going to have to try to do the best that I can on my own? And so think about these things. I think these are really important things to consider. So, reasons to marry a faithful Christian. Christ is our life. You do not know that you will be able to convert your spouse. Marriage is a spiritual endeavor. And one last thing that we'll talk about, we need to understand something. And Christians, our eyes need to be open to this. Our spouse is going to become the strongest human influence in our life. That's not an accident. God made it that way. God said, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. Our spouse will become the strongest human influence in our lives. Our spouse will surpass the influence of our parents in our lives. That's what's going to happen. And so we need to be aware of that. We need to be honest about that. And sometimes, you know, sometimes maybe as we're thinking about this, we're thinking about our spouse and we're thinking about, you know, a potential mate and they're not a Christian. And maybe we may say something to ourselves like, well, you know, my spouse is a moral person. My spouse is not going to be, you know, getting engaged in all kinds of immorality and trying to tempt me or being a temptation to me in that way. My spouse is not a morally corrupt person. And so someone would say, you know, they would go over to 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 33, do not be deceived, evil company corrupts good habits. And we might say to ourselves, well, that doesn't apply in this situation because my spouse is not evil company. My spouse is not morally corrupt. And I would just say that, you know, that may be the case, but let me just say, I hope there's nobody in our lives that is morally corrupt and just really devoted to immorality. And so you're saying, I mean, we're saying about this person here that we're thinking about marrying, they're not morally corrupt, like that's some big accomplishment. I pray to God that there's nobody in our lives who is just given immorality and we're close to them and allowing ourselves to be influenced by them. But it's not just dangerous to be closely associated with morally corrupt people. What about indifferent people? Is indifferent a small thing, an insignificant thing, indifference? You remember what Jesus said to the church in Laodicea? Because you are lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will vomit you out of my mouth. Are those words of praise? I will vomit you out of my mouth. Do you take the best dessert that you've ever eaten in your life that your wife has made for you? Do you take a bite of that and just spit that out all over the place? That's not a compliment. Those aren't words of praise. Indifference. When we talk about the church at Laodicea, sometimes what we say when I'm talking to the girls, Laodicea, the church that made Jesus sick. The church that nauseated the Lord. Indifference is a terrible quality. Indifference toward the Lord. And here's how indifference might affect us. Our spouse doesn't want us to go to services. Not because they think it's a bad thing, or if it's that it's negatively going to affect the relationship. But they're just not zealous for the Lord. They'd rather just spend the time with us. Just, hey, can't you just stay home with me today? You know, I've got the day off. You know, we can watch movies or we can go out. We haven't had any, you know, quality time. And now you're going to go off to worship and I can't go with you. Well, yeah, you can. You can go with me, but there's still that pressure that is you know, a possibility, just something we need to think about. And obviously we need to think about the influence that our spouse will have on our children. Peter tells us that Lot was a righteous man. In the midst of all that immorality in Sodom, Lot maintained his integrity. But his children were destroyed by the influence of the people of Sodom. And I just want to, here's something, a point that we need to be honest about. Don't we know that the influence of an unbelieving parent is going to be so much stronger than the influence of unbelieving friends? Something for us to consider. And so here are some reasons. Reasons to marry a faithful Christian. I hope this doesn't sound all doom and gloom, but I'm trying to help you to think honestly about you know, what you're getting into. And you may still decide to do this in spite of all that I've said. But think honestly about these things. Think carefully about them. But I want to just spend some time talking about something else for just a moment. You know, sometimes I think we've got young Christians who believe all of these things, who understand all of these things, but they look and they look and they spend some time looking. They have trouble. They have trouble meeting a faithful Christian. What do we do in that situation? Well, here's a few things that we'll ask. A few of them are maybe things that we ask as far as taking stock of ourselves and really being honest about our preparation. But then some other things. You know, is there maybe something that I could do to change the situation, to make it better, to make myself in a better position to meet someone who is a Christian? The first question we ask is this: am I really ready? Okay, maybe in my mind I think I'm ready. And you know, give yourself, you know, parents and children alike, give yourself a little mercy on this point, because I mean, in a lot of ways, I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready when I married. I don't know. You know, I don't know if you find yourself in a situation where you can say perfectly, "Yes, now I'm ready. I know everything I need to know." That's just not how it works. But am I mature enough? You know, am I really ready to leave my parents? An important question to ask ourselves: am I already serving the Lord faithfully? Because the kind of person that you're going to want to marry, they're going to notice that. They're going to look and see, are you serving the Lord faithfully? They're going to be aware of that. Are you ready to leave your parents? Do you have an independent faith? Are you able to function, you know, are you able to function on the basis of your faith? You know, these are things that the kind of people you want to marry, they're going to be looking for and aware of. So just kind of start there. I mean, am I really ready? You know, what are some things maybe that I can be working on? Am I really looking for the right qualities? There's a young girl. She's not here. And maybe she'll never hear this example. But I think it was a telling and important example. I think it's something that she probably learned from, whether she realizes it or not. But I think she was a spiritually minded girl. I think she loved the Lord. But she once said that she would settle for nothing less than a Tim Tebow. And so she was thinking, looks, successful, but I have to be honest with you. So far as Tim Tebow's faith is concerned, I'm just pretty confident that I'd have a lot of disagreements with Tim Tebow and some of the things that he would teach about salvation. And I don't want to pick on, Tim Tebow here, but this is just an example where sometimes we may not realize that we're looking in the wrong direction. And it can take a long time to realize that we're looking in the wrong direction. So I'm going to say this, and this is maybe directed more at the young ladies, because we need a lot of mercy. Young men need a lot of mercy. Keep an open mind. A weird guy comes around and, he's trying to talk to you and he's awkward. He's just so nervous. He thinks you are so out of his league. But really, just give him a chance. Watch what he does, how he serves the Lord. Watch what he does in Bible class. And, especially if you're really young, you don't have to be in a hurry. But learn how to watch people and recognize faithfulness in them. And learn to be attracted to that. Keep an open mind. And being attracted to faithfulness is so important because, of course, physical attraction fades. It does. The way that we look physically, eventually that fades. And physical success can be lost. So, just keep an open mind. Am I really looking for the right qualities? Here's a question to ask. And I can't answer this question for you, but it's worth considering. Is my environment the problem? And by environment, I don't mean, the environment of the local church where you may be a member. But sometimes the local church where you may be a member, there may not be any other young people. In Genesis 24 is an interesting story. Well, I think it bears some weight in the context of our conversation here. It says in verse 1, Abraham was old, well advanced in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. So Abraham said to the oldest servant of his house, who ruled over all that he had, please put your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of the earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell, but you shall go to my country and to my family and take a wife for my son Isaac. Just based on the end of chapter 23, it seems very likely that Abraham was in Hebron when he said this, when he did this, and the servant was going to go to Padanaram, probably Haran, the city where Abraham had parted ways with his family so many years ago. You look that up on a map, you get different estimates, but I'm going to tell you, it's almost 500 miles from Hebron. It's almost 500 miles by Hebron, and he's not driving a car or taking a plane. He's on a camel. It's probably about 17 days there on the back of a camel, and 17 days home on the back of a camel with Rebecca. Why go to all this trouble? We know the answer, don't we? Isaac was not going to marry a Canaanite. Period. That's it. It wasn't even up for consideration. Isaac was not going to marry a Canaanite. And so, it's 500 miles, I know. It's 17 days by camel, I know. But you go and find a wife for my son from among my family. The point that I'm saying is that we may need to exert some effort to meet someone. It may be considerable effort. And, here's a reality that we need to prepare for. We may need to exert effort more than once. Maybe I go somewhere a couple of times and I meet some people and, I went a long ways and went to some trouble. I didn't really find anybody I clicked with. And so I go somewhere else and you may need to exert some effort, some serious effort, to find someone. But I hope that you will have the attitude that Abraham had. Isaac was not going to marry a Canaanite, no matter what. Here's a question. Am I trying too hard? You know, here we're getting into a little bit of opinion, but maybe what we'll just say in terms of, as far as what we mean here, we're talking about maybe being aware of the situation that we live in. And the first thing that we can say is this. I mean, this is related to the idea of maturity, being ready, you know, being able to, you know, to function in the situation with wisdom, with patience. Dating to marry can be a slow process. It can be. You know, just don't think about me and Kendra's example, because that's not how it always works. But dating to marry can be a slow process, and it often is a slow process. For better or for worse, this is how things work in our culture. Someone might say, wouldn't it be better if we arranged marriages? Well, maybe. But, you know, it would still be a process that we would have to go through and kind of recognize and be aware of. Now, can two faithful Christians learn to love each other? Absolutely. And they do. You know, even if we feel confident that we love each other before we get married, you know, the love grows and hopefully is growing and should be growing. But sometimes the fact that two faithful Christians, the fact that, yes, they can learn to love each other, guys, we need to make sure that we're not thinking this way. We're not thinking that, okay, well, I mean, you know, I'm a Christian, and you're a Christian, so what's the problem? Let's get married. That's just not how things work in our culture. You know, we tend to date to marry, or some may court to marry, but either way, the young lady has the right to expect some romantic pursuit. You know, some sense in which you are trying to show that, you know, it's not just, okay, let's put it on paper. Here are the facts. I'm a Christian, you're a Christian. So, hey, so far the case is strong, right? We've got to find a way how to communicate about our faith, because I think we all know that there are people that we love in the body of Christ who love the Lord, but it's harder for us to communicate about our faith with some of them than it is with others. What all the factors may be, I don't know. But we have to take some time. Can we communicate about our faith? You know, what about when we disagree? What's going to happen? What are we going to talk? And so, you know, how are we going to go work through a situation like this? And so, you know, it's just something young men realize, that young ladies in our culture, I believe, have a right to expect some level of romantic pursuit and time taken to kind of, you know, learn and see where this could go, where we want to go. But I will offer this advice, which is maybe something similar to what we said in the first point. As we're waiting, trying to be patient, you know, there's a lot of things that we can be doing. Everybody is waiting for something. I've got Matthew 24 up there, where Jesus talks about the servant who waits one way and the servant who waits another way. One servant waits in such a way that he is doing what the Lord told him to do. He's executing his stewardship in a faithful way. And it says in verse 47, when the Lord returns, he will make him ruler over all his goods. But there's an evil servant in verse 48 who says in his heart, oh, my master is delaying. And he begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with the drunkards. The master of that servant will come on a day when he is not looking for him, and at an hour that he is not aware of, and he will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. You know, as a young person, you know, who's waiting, who's been trying to date, trying to meet someone for a long time, it can feel like, you know, I'm saying some of these things because I know sometimes maybe you feel like giving up. You feel like, well, maybe I could take a chance on someone. You know, and maybe you could, you know, kind of date someone and talk to someone who's not a Christian. But, you know, if there's any indication that this person is not going to be interested in spiritual things, you need to be prepared to end it. Paul says, how do you know? And so you're waiting, and sometimes maybe you feel desperate and you feel like, I've been waiting and waiting. Let me just offer you this little, you know, some fact that maybe you don't think of as a young person. Everybody's waiting on something. Everybody's waiting on something. I mean, you know, somebody's got a health issue and they're waiting to find out what's going on with it, and they're going to the doctor over and over and nothing's happening. Everybody's waiting on the Lord to return, and we've got things to be doing. Everybody's waiting on something. We need to find ways to be busy. And I'll tell you, as a single person, you need to really rely on your brethren. Whether this is right or wrong, I mean, sometimes I just go to people's house, I just show up. Look, I'm lonely, and I can't stay at home alone anymore. And so I'd go over there, and there'd be some opportunities to be encouraged. And there's all kinds of ways that we can encourage others. If you get busy serving the Lord, maybe there's another faithful person out there who's waiting, and they're looking for a faithful person, and they see you busy serving the Lord. That's your best opportunity. Sitting around feeling sorry for yourself, that's not going to help the situation. It's not. The last thing that I'll say is have a plan, but be flexible. It doesn't take, you know, you don't have to have many conversations, and this might be worth doing, young people. Go talk to some older couples, some couples who have been married for a while, even some younger couples. Ask them how they met, hear about their story, and what you will find out is everybody's story is a little different. Some maybe are really different. Some are maybe you're thinking, I don't know if they should have done it that way. But I think what we can agree upon, you know, if you go around and hear some stories, and then you look at people's lives and you look at how things are working out for them, I think you will come away with this, I think you'll feel this way. There's no perfect age to get married. There's no perfect engagement period. The most important factor will be mutual devotion to God. And I'll just tell you, my wife was 19 when we got married, 20 when we had our first kid. That's not the way everybody does it. And we probably, from the time that we started dating and were married, was probably less than 6 months. A lot of people don't do it that way these days. But, you know, Kendra and I had both had some long relationships, and we just reached a point where we knew, yeah, look, I'm ready to really get serious. I'm ready to start working on, you know, building my life together with someone. And so just realize that there's nothing wrong with having a plan, but be flexible. Be flexible because you will probably be married longer than you will do anything else in your life. You will be married longer than you work. You will be married longer than you have children at home. You will be married longer than anything else that you do. And so if the right person comes along, but it means maybe I'm going to put my plan on hold for a little bit, go ahead and make a way to make the person fit into your life if the right person comes along, because now you can have someone to work that plan with together, supporting you and encouraging you. Be willing to change your plans for a godly person. And this is another reason why we've got to be somewhat flexible. Because marriage is about building a life together, and the person that you are marrying has the right to have some plans too. And so you say, well, I'm going to do this and this, and I'm going to do it this way and on this time. They may not see it just like you do it. They may not see it just the way you see it. They may want to slip this in before this. If you have confidence that this is a godly person, you know, I'm going to strongly ask you to consider changing your plan. And one last piece of advice. You know, I think we can see the wisdom of this. In all of this, as we're thinking about who we would marry, in all of this, you know, we're thinking about the other person a lot. Let's make sure that we spend as much time thinking about what God tells us to be as we do thinking about what God tells our spouse to be. Because no one has more control over, I mean, that's the situation I have the most control over. How I will act, how I will behave. And, you know, this is the situation that I will answer for, too. You know, God forbid that someone ends up in a situation where their spouse just doesn't do what they are supposed to do, just doesn't do what God tells them to do. I don't have to answer for that. But I do have to answer for how I behaved and what I did. And so it's very important throughout this process to spend as much time reflecting on what God says to you, if you're a husband, to you if you're a wife, as you do thinking about what God says to the other part of your marriage. All right, well, I don't know what I need to do to just kind of go ahead and set it up right here. I don't know if you need to pass this off to you in just a moment, Eric. One thing I will say, just kind of, you know, that we said we would come back to this at the end. Marriage will still challenge us, even if we are very careful in choosing a mate. But, you know, let me say some words of encouragement here. You have every right, every reason to believe that your marriage will be joyous, that your marriage will be happy, if you commit to the problems that you face in life, if you commit to facing those together while serving the Lord. You know, there's some things that, you can't predict hurricanes. You can't predict market crashes. I mean, there are things that are going to, you are going to find yourself and you're going to say, I did everything right, but I'm having money problems. It'll be something that's out of your hands. You can't predict a lot of this stuff. But what you can do is stand together in faithfulness to the Lord. And I'll just go ahead and tell you, I think this is true for everyone in the room. I say this sometimes, and I think this is true for everyone in the room. You know, there are situations in my past, maybe a lot of them, and maybe for you too. There are situations in my past that I just, at the time that they were happening, I just thought to myself, I don't see any way we can get through these things. How are we going to get through this? Well, let me just tell you that so far, God's record for getting me through those kinds of situations in the past is 100%. He's gotten me through every one of those situations in the past. I didn't know how it... He'll get me through this one too, whatever it may be. Doesn't matter what it is. Just as long as I continue to serve the Lord and depend on the Lord together. You have every reason to expect that you can have joy and love in your marriage and that it will be something that blesses you. At this time, we are going to give an opportunity for someone to respond to the gospel in whatever way they may need. You know, I want to draw your minds back to what we said in Colossians 3. That Christ has brought us together. It's a wonderful blessing, these relationships. Christ has brought us together. If you would like to be a part of that, if you would like to live your life in such a way as to have hope that when He comes again, you will be able to be with Him in glory, we hope that you will be willing to do what Paul talks about in Colossians 3, to die, to put yourself to death, to put your will to death, to take on the clothing of Christ, so to speak, and let yourself be clothed with Christ and clothed with His will and give your life to Him and live for Him. You can have that hope even right now if you will respond. We ask you to come as we sing together.